Tonight and probably for a few more nights this fall, I'm going to be taking suttas, and breaking them down and looking at them. The Buddha taught in some ways in very sort of classical philosophical ways, and one method of presenting an idea completely that he uses and other philosophical systems have used as well is you can take two things. So there's A and B, right? And then they can combine in four ways. Good. Those of you familiar with binary numbers will understand that. So it's like you can have A and B, A not B, not A, B, not A, not B. That's it. You got four choices. And he takes these four choices to explain things he's talking about. And if you've ever heard me talk about wholesome effort, one of the sixth step in the Eightfold Path, that's one of those examples. And I actually refer to it a little bit in this talk, though it's indirectly. And so, the topic of tonight's Dharma talk is more suffering or more happiness. And it's based on this thing called the Kula Dhamma Samadana Sutta. Please excuse my Pali. And this is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's called, the name is off, it's translated as the Shorter Discourse on Ways of Undertaking Things. Okay, so I'm going to just read a little bit of this sutta. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I want to read so you can see what I'm talking about here. Bhikkhus, there are four ways of undertaking things. What are the four? There's the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. There's a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. There's a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. There's a way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. So, four things, right? Pleasant to start, painful in the end. Painful to start, painful in the end. Painful to start, pleasant in the end. Pleasant to start, pleasant in the end. Number four is what one we all want, of course, but we actually have to deal with all four of these. So, the first of these is in the Buddhist teachings. Basically, how he describes a lot of living in the world with heedlessly. It's like so pleasant to start, painful in the end. This is sort of, in a way, a description of normal life, life that people lead when they're not being mindful, where we keep looking for things that are pleasant now. Whatever it is. And then we forget, we keep forgetting that the results of those things that are pleasant now are often painful, unpleasant in the end. So we do something pleasant and then we notice later on that we've harmed our body or harmed our mind in some way. Harmed our relationships, who knows? There's a like that classic phrase you hear, a moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips, right? Which is funny, but it's like it has some implications here, right? And it's that sort of thing where, that moment on the lips, that chocolate brownie was really good, but then we have to deal with the results of that chocolate brownie for future time. And I'm not saying you should never eat chocolate brownies. I mean, I would be fibbing if I told you not to ever eat chocolate brownies, because I like chocolate brownies. Moderation, right? Moderation. It's, and I'm using that example, just it's kind of a little silly, but. And what the Buddha is pointing to here is that we often seek out things that are pleasant, and we consume things that are pleasant, but they end up with not so good results in the end. As you probably, I'm sure I told you, I'm a hospital chaplain on Thursdays. And the amount of times I see people who have done this, who are have problems with alcohol, with drugs, with food, with other ways of abusing their body. But at the time, it was like, oh, this was great. And then there they are, somewhat some time later, suffering the consequences of the abuse they've done. It's, I would say 30% of the people I see in a hospital fit into that category. People who just have bought into, well, this is pleasant, so I'll keep doing it, even though it ends up being quite unpleasant in the end. And when I say things we consume, I also want to make sure we understand that I'm not talking about stuff like food and drugs and alcohol, those sorts of consumptions, but also how we consume things at the mental level. We can consume things from the level of media. My favorite example is, for me, this is for me personally, I used to love any kind of movie that was really well done. Like, I had a great director and good actors. And if it was really violent, that was okay because it was so well done, right? I can't watch those movies anymore. I just can't. I can't consume that because I see how it affects me later. Pleasant in the moment because it's like, wow, this acting is so wonderful, and look at the, all that stuff. And then it's like, ugh, but then afterwards, I sort of, not to the level of nightmares, though that happens sometimes, but just like it eats at you, those sorts of things. And so we have to be very conscious not to get caught in this loop of seeking out the pleasant all the time. Joseph Goldstein, of course, has something to say about this as well. This is from his book, Mindfulness, and I want to share a little bit of this. And he's talking about this in the context, as I mentioned, is of right effort. This is the first of the four in the right effort understanding. This aspect of right effort points to a fundamental understanding of how our minds work. In the suttas, the most pragmatic description of nibbana is a mind that is free from the root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. We've all experienced many wholesome mind moments when these defilements are not present, yet have also had unwholesome factors frequently reemerge as conditions change. This is the functioning of what are called latent defilements, mind states that are not present in the moment, but have the potential to arise whenever the conditions for them to reappear are present. Now, causes and conditions arise, and we fall back into that unwholesome pattern again. Even though at the moment we're doing fine, right? It is just this understanding that can inspire a feeling of spiritual urgency. This is one of Joseph's favorite topics. When we're leading basically good and wholesome lives, it is easy to become complacent about our present circumstances. But even under these favorable conditions, we will have many moments when greed, hatred, or delusion arises. We see something beautiful and we want it. Our minds are pulled towards it. Or perhaps we see somebody doing something we don't like, and the mind is suddenly filled with judgment and aversion. Or you may be tired and the mind simply dulls out in delusion. So the first of the four great endeavors is recognizing the enduring power of these latent defilements, understanding what gives us rise to them and preventing them from arising and taking hold. So this is a definition of the first of the four forms of right effort. Seeing, I like to think it and express it in a way of, I see where this is going, I know where this is going, I've been this down this road before, I know if I keep going down this road, there I'm going to be stuck in that hole in the road again and have to deal with consequences. So it's like we see it and we have understanding of the unwholesome results, and we go, no, I don't need to do that. So that's the first of these four. And then the next one of these, huh? Painful to start and painful in the end. My notes here say, a good description of those habits we have that we know causes and others suffering, but we continue with them anyway. Does this seem at all familiar to you? This is something we all do. We have certain patterns, but they're so like, well, that's who I am. It's how I am. I'm that way. And we just continue on with them. It's also a description of addiction. This is what someone who's addicted to whatever they're addicted to, whether it's alcohol or drugs or porn or who knows, whatever, food, chocolate brownies, you can be addicted to those. And we do this. This is a human quality, human characteristics that we fall into these patterns. And because we've always done it that way, or well, that's just who I am, I do this, we let these things continue. And this is also it's a good definition of insanity. I like this actually. Insanity is repeating the same action over and over again, expecting a different result, which is also what we do sometimes. Well, this time, I won't end up in that big hole down the road. This time it's going to be different. I've done it 100 times, and every time I've done it, I end up in the same place. But this time, we keep fooling ourselves into believing that we'll get a different result. And this is the second form of right effort, in a sense. When an unwholesome mind state has arisen, do whatever you can to end it. See it for what it is, and then go, oh, here I am, stuck in this hole again. I don't have to stay here any longer. I can change. I'm capable of change. I don't have to repeat this pattern over and over again. It takes effort. This isn't easy. I'm not pretending it isn't easy. That it's easy, because it's not. Because these are deeply ingrained habits we have. So this is a bit more Joseph Goldstein here. And he's talking about the hindrances, which is what I've been talking about obliquely in a sense. At times, though, the hindrances may be tenacious, and we need additional strategies for abandoning them. In one sutta, the Buddha describes five techniques for dispelling distracting thoughts and unwholesome mind states. First is using its opposite as an antidote. For example, if ill will has arisen, we can refocus the mind on metta, on goodwill, loving kindness. Or if restlessness is present, calming the mind through calming the breath may be helpful. If envy or jealousy is strong, we can turn the mind to feeling of mudita, empathetic joy. All of these remedies come from understanding that we have an inner remote control with the ability to change channels. It's like, here's my mind stuck in this channel, and I go, I don't really have to be here. But then we have these skillful means to actually shift. Just if often, when we're caught in one of these unwholesome mind states, there's a story running in our mind, right? Often starring me, usual, almost always starring me. And sometimes I'm the hero and sometimes I'm the villain, and sometimes this other person's the villain and they're really bad and blah, blah, blah. And when we get caught in those places, we just can go, oh, how about instead I think about the good in this person? I know there's some good in this person. Or I know there's some good in me. I can look back at my own past actions and see the wholesome things I've done. Instead of dwelling over and over again on the unwholesome, start to consciously choose to dwell on the wholesome instead. Shift. It's like shifting gears. Shifting, steering the mind a little bit. Joseph goes on. The second means of removing unwholesome states already arisen is through the factors of hiri and otapa, often translated respectively as self-respect and respect for the wise. The wise being great teachers. These wholesome factors of mind can be a heightened sense of conscience and responsibility. Reflecting on how the wise might view an unwholesome mind state or activity is often a powerful ally in this endeavor to abandon what is unwholesome for this reason. These factors are called the guardians of the world. Care is also needed here so that this review of our actions is done from a place of wise understanding and not simply feeding into patterns of self-judgment or guilt. Yeah, gotta watch that, because it's like, oh, here I am caught here again. Oh, I'm so bad. I'm just the worst person in the world. It's so easy to end up there if we're not careful. So it's not what we're doing. We're just going, oh, I can see that this is unwholesome. And right now, in this moment, despite my history, despite having been there 100 times, I don't have to be there. I can change. That we have this ability to change. Just Joseph's last line here. But used wisely, hiri and otapa can awaken us from the power of deluded thinking. Because often that's all that's going on. There's something, some deeply deluded thought process going on that, like I said, well, it'll be okay this time. Even though it wasn't okay the last 100. It's so easy to fall into that as well, believing somehow it's going to be different this time, because typically it isn't. So that's the second of these four. Then we have the third one, painful to start and pleasant in the end. So first off, here's the problem. Painful in the start, our habitual patterns of mind go, oh, this is painful, I'm getting out of here. Aversion is going to arise. Right? But in a way, painful to start, pleasant in the end, it's a pretty good description of what practice can be like sometimes. There we are, innocently sitting still, our mind is clear, and something happens that we can look at wisely and go, ah, I can see that unwholesome pattern. And then really consciously choose not to. And often it's just like some old story. It's not even like if we've fallen into the pattern, just some old story's arisen and we go, yeah, this is, we've taken a close look at it, because we have to learn, and that's the other side of this, is there are things that arise that are memories or plans for the future sometimes, And we have to learn from these things when we see where they're going. Oh, this is what happened. I have to, here's what I can do to when this situation that arises again, I can skillfully shift. And also, I have to look at these things that are painful as they are. Like you're sitting there and all of a sudden you realize how you're really like grumpy or sad or whatever, and you're going, I have to look at, pay attention to what it feels like in the body, tune into it. Don't pay attention to the accompanying story, because it's almost always going to be a story. But instead, sort of tune into what it feels like and be able to skillfully name it. And then sort of hang out with it. And then you start to see, this story isn't me at all. This is just some story. This is just something that arose at the level of mind. It was unpleasant, but under that unpleasant experience, we start to get a clearer understanding that of, impermanence or not self or unsatisfactoriness, the three factors. By consciously choosing to stay with this unpleasant place and look at it, clearly look at it, instead of just being averse of it and pushing it away and pretending it's not there. We have to accept that we have a dark side. We all want to think, oh, not me, boy. I'm perfect. I'm happy all the time. That's what, when I was a hippie, that's what we all thought. Like, oh no, it's peace and love all the time. And ignored the fact that there was a dark side that was clearly there, and we didn't want to, we just pretended it wasn't there at all. So we have to be willing to actually sit with these things, look at them honestly, and understand that life is not always going to be pleasant and wonderful, that things, unpleasant things are going to arise, but that we can use those as places where we learn from. Through the experience of processing these things, we start to have a deeper understanding of our life and how we operate in the world. And this leads very directly to more happiness. Back to my title, right? Yes, it was unpleasant at the beginning as we struggled through it. But as we stayed with it and felt it on the physical level and on the mental level and learned how to see it for what it is, just the temporary mental arising, then that calm, happy, peaceful state can arise as well. By being willing to stay with the unpleasant, which is hard. I'm not saying this is like, oh well, nobody can do this, no problem. This is where the difficulty in practice, and this is where, to be honest with you, when this stuff starts to arise more frequently, this is when people leave the practice. I've seen this many times. It's like, people come in thinking, oh, this is all going to be like peace and love and glory, and I'm going to just learn how to meditate. And they actually do. They get develop a skill, and they learn how to concentrate and still the mind and be focused. And then, lo and behold, what arises is all the stuff they stuffed away and didn't want to think about. What a surprise that that's what you got. And we have to sort of live through those things and look at them and be really honest with ourselves about them. And then they start to lose their power, and more and more often what arises is door number four, which is pleasant to start, pleasant in the end. This is also a description of practice. And we can't forget this part, because it's important. And there are times when we're just sitting doing our practice, whether it's like in our formal practice or just in our life in general, or just being mindful as we go through our day, where it's just like everything's kind of sweet, pleasant, joyful. And it's really important that we notice this, that we have these times that are sweet and joyful, either in our sitting practice, our formal practice, or just in our life. Because it's so much easier to just get caught in the, oh, I'm so bad, I'm so, look at all these horrible things that happened, look at all these things in the past, oh my God, what about the future? And get caught up in that turmoil, the unpleasant turmoil, that we don't acknowledge that there's also times when sweetness and calm is what's there. And we have to really consciously acknowledge that. And this is the last step in the right effort. When a wholesome mind state has arisen, we should do what we can to preserve that wholesomeness. And we can do that. I'm not saying we should cling to it, which is bound to make it unwholesome just like that. But I mean, it's like, acknowledge it, note it, like, oh, calm and sweetness is here right now. Pleasantness is here right now. Joy is here right now. Because that also happens to everyone. No matter who you are, how difficult your life is in the moment or whatever, there's always moments of joy there. I was talking to a gentleman today in the hospital who had lost everything in the Marshall Fire 7 years ago, or whatever, how many years ago that was. And he was still upset by it. And I remember this other gentleman I spoke to not long after the Marshall Fire. And they were well off, he and his wife. Had no kids, and so they spent a lot of their money traveling and going to exotic places and collecting artifacts. That was their thing. And so they had this house basically laid out and designed to store and present all of these beautiful things. But they were getting on, and he'd started to go, oh, what am I going to do with all this stuff? Who am I going to give it to? Who's going to take care of it? Oh my God, have I got enough insurance for it? Blah, blah, blah. All the stuff that people worry about when they have beautiful things, right? And then the Marshall Fire came. All this 50 years worth of collecting stuff was gone. And he said to me, and I was really surprised, we were talking about it, and he said, I really, all these wonderful things. He said, it's such a relief because now I don't have to think about this stuff anymore. Unpleasant in the beginning, pleasant in the end. It's like, it's just an interesting take, because usually when we think of things like that, it's like people are just always going to be really upset that their house burnt down and all their stuff is gone. And this guy was like, relieved. Oh my God, thank God I don't have to think and worry about that stuff anymore. Shift in attitude, right? And what I'm trying to get across here, I guess, is that it's really important that we enjoy our practice, our formal practice, and that we enjoy our lives. Joy is like an important part of life, and we need to cultivate it and encourage it and do whatever we can to create the causes and conditions so that it might arise more. And over time, that's what this practice does, in my experience anyway. Over long periods of time with this practice, the times when I'm sort of more joyful and full, sort of the smiling and having a good time in life in general, seem to have gotten more frequent over the years. And maybe that's just a factor of me getting old and not noticing things so much, but I don't think so. I think it's very directly related to having gone deep into the practice and created the conditions such that joy is a more frequent visitor in my life. I like to think of it that way anyway. Anyhow, so that's this thing about more suffering and more happiness. What the Buddha is pointing to here, and this is sort of the overall theme, I think, this is a choice. We can't avoid the what one of my friends calls the existential suffering. We get sick, we get hurt, like someone runs, wrecks our car, we lose our job. That stuff is just stuff that happens. We can't avoid that. This is having a body and living in the world. But how we react to those things when they arise is a greater cause of more suffering than the actual things themselves. It's like it's this image that the Buddha uses. You're hit by an arrow, and you sit there and think, why me? Why am I? Why do I have this arrow sticking in me? Right? And in that process of sort of beating yourself up and trying to figure it out, what you're basically doing is taking a second arrow and going, let's stick another one in. And we're just compounding our suffering instead of just going, okay, this is what I got. I really don't like it sometimes. Sometimes, oh my God, this is just wonderful. And then just moving on from there without dwelling on it. Sometimes we need to understand things, we can learn from things that we've done when we've been unskillful. But once we thought about it five times, we've thought about it enough. But we dwell on things often. We go over them over and over and over and over again. Anyhow, so that's one sutta. There's another sutta here that's related in some ways to this. And this is called the Vanapata Sutta. And I want to do a little bit of explanation here. The Buddha encouraged his bhikkhus, the monastics, to practice in places that had two qualities. One, they were sort of remote, and they would go and they wouldn't be disturbed while they were practicing. But at the same time, they had to be close enough to some village so that they could get what were called the requisites. They could get the food once a day. They would do their rounds. They could have some sort of crude shelter. Often the local people would help them build some sort of crude shelter because they liked having monastics around. And they needed a robe, and they needed medicine when they were sick, which is one other thing that the villagers would supply. That's it. Those were called the good requisites. If you got those four things, daily food, once a day you get some food, you got a place to a shelter, and you have your robes, and you have medicine when you need it. That's all the bhikkhus needed. That was their idea of enough. It's pretty simple living, basically. And so this particular sutta, I'll just read a little bit of it here. Here, because a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While he is living there, his unestablished mindfulness does not become established. His unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. His undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. It has not attained the unattained supreme security from bondage, and also the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth, robes, alms food, resting place, and medicine, medicinal requisites, are hard to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I'm living in this jungle thicket. While I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness, etc., it's time for me to go someplace else. And then, so this is, once again, this set of 5 four. There's you're not succeeding, and there are the requisites aren't available, the poor requisites. You need to go. You need to change where you're practicing. Not succeeding, good requisites. Like you got out lots of good food and everything's taken care of, but you're not, your practice isn't growing. Go. Time to change location. Because it's like, I'll talk about this, but it's like, you have to, you have good requisites. It's kind of like, yeah, my practice isn't going that great, but boy, the food they give me every day in the village is just great. And they really taking care of it. They really made me a really nice hut. And, why would I want to go, right? But if you're not, your practice isn't growing, time to go. Then, and the opposite of that, of course, is you're succeeding. Your practice is growing, as the Buddha describes it. But the requisites aren't that great. Stay anyway. Your practice is what's most important. And then succeeding, and you got good requisites, stay for sure. Right? Those are the four choices again. And I think it's useful to apply this to our lives, very directly to our lives. I mean, and we have to be careful with this, but is it like, do I feel like my practice is heading in the right direction? Do I feel some growth? Is it working? And I have to take a really long view. By working, I mean, are you more frequently, perhaps just a little bit more frequently, in a state where there's joy, where there's calm, where there's peacefulness, where there's less disturbance? That's a successful practice. And it's tricky because we start to judge our practice, and we got to be very careful about that. Like saying, oh, well, my practice is, I'm not, I haven't reached, Nibbana yet. What's wrong with me? I've been practicing for a whole year now. It's, you can go there too, and that's not skillful at all. But being able to see that how I'm living my life, the things I have, the job I'm doing, the relationships I have, all that stuff. That's for a householder. Those are our requisites, right? The things we need to sort of function in the world as a householder, which are different. We need a little bit more than a robe and a begging bowl and a nice hut someplace. But am I so attached to my requisites that it's getting in the way of my practice, of not having enough time or energy to practice? Because I'm so busy working all the time to make money to get more requisites. Which is what, of course, our culture encourages us to do, right? So we need to sort of pause sometimes and go, does this make sense? Is what, how I'm living my life right now in the world leading towards my practice growing? And sometimes it means my practice is growing, but my requisites aren't so great anymore. And I don't have a big income anymore or anything like that. I'm having to really simplify my life, perhaps. But if my practice is growing, it's okay. And then sometimes, like I said, sometimes like your practice is growing and you have everything you need. Everything that you need to sort of lead a simple, happy life. You've got a roof over your head that doesn't leak. You have enough food. You have a job that's okay, that you enjoy doing, that seems useful. You're doing useful, something useful for the world. You can get around okay. That's great requisites. And if you have that and your practice is growing, that's the two thumbs up. Stay right there, just keep doing what you're doing. But it's this is what the Buddha is pointing to here is we have to look and see what's going on with our practice and with our life. You know, monastics, it was simple. They only had to look at, you know, do I got enough food, and are they giving me, have they helped me make a nice little kuti that I can hang out in that keeps the rain off my head. As householders, it's a lot more complicated. We have much more complicated lives. So we have to think about it, but we have to stop and think about it in terms of, does how I'm leading my life and what I'm striving to do with my life lead to my practice having a greater chance of growing? This is a difficult question. But like everything else in the world, this is something, you know, if we're really taking this practice seriously, we can't just go, oh, well, I sit for half an hour every day and then there's the rest of my life. We have to put the formal practice in the context of our entire life. How does that life make sense in the context of the practice? And that's, everybody has a different idea of what that means. And everybody has to figure, I'm not saying just, you know, you should all become poor and go live in a little hut someplace. I don't. I have a nice house in Boulder, right? I mean, I'm not going to say anything. So it's interesting that we have to look at these things. Then the last section of the sutta, however, says something really interesting. Because it goes on to say that the same applies to a bhikkhu might be practicing in a particular village, town, city, or country, or dependent on a particular person. This advice doesn't just apply to renunciates, and it doesn't just apply to renunciates living in jungle thickets, which was the traditional form. I mean, there's lots of renunciates who live right in the thick of the world. Think of Mother Teresa, for instance, one of my favorite renunciates. She lived in the midst of the squalor of India's cities. But her practice was so powerful that she was perfectly fine with the fact that she lived in incredibly simple places where she didn't have a lot of anything, but she always had her practice. And you know, and the nuns, they did mass every day without fail. No matter what else is going on, they'd all stop and practice together as a way to keep the practice, what they were doing in the world, energized. So it's like, no matter whether you're a renunciate or just a regular old householder person, we have to stop and think about these things. It's so easy just to sort of, you know, as Joseph said, well, I'm doing fine, I'm happy, everything's great, and leave it there. It's like, oh, I should actually look at all this stuff. Do I really need all this stuff? Do I really, these things that my culture tells me I have to have, do I really need them? And sometimes the answer is yes, and that's okay. You know, people with families, boy, they need stuff. I mean, when I had two kids, boy, I needed a lot of stuff. Just because you have to take care of the kids and do all that stuff that's going on. Whatever. And so I guess what I'm getting to is that both of these suttas, in a sense, are trying to say two things. One is that we have to step back and look at our whole life and see, does it make sense in terms of practice? It's a big question. And then the second thing is, How we decide what to do with our inner life should be directly determined by what effect it will have on our practice. It's like what I'm saying is we have to make practice art the most important thing in our life. And everything else has to fit into making that practice move deeper. Everything. That's a big ask. But it's like, that's what I'm suggesting. We want to pause and look at things and go, oh, what about that? You know, and I'm sure we've all had moments like that in our lives more than once. We're all old enough that we had to make several decisions in our lives to end up where we are now. And hopefully all those decisions were wholesome and lead towards you sitting here with me in the Thursday night, and saying, we could all be watching hockey or something right now instead. But here we are, talking about the Dhamma. So, of course, I have a little piece of poetry to finish this off. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And it's called A Voice Spoke in the Twilight. A voice spoke in the twilight, for I will carry you across the wide river of life and see you safely to the other side. Be unafraid and joyous. On this shared journey, you will see miracles. You will know sadness. The heart of your heart will be glad, and at times you will suffer, but there won't be a single moment when you'll stray from the path. If you could only believe that right now, this moment is a part of the journey, perhaps you'd see the futility of worry or despair. I will carry you no matter if you find the way easy and safe or rife with danger and impossibility. I will keep you in the presence and in the light of truth. This is my covenant with you. I speak soul to soul. And I say only what is true. With that, the night went back to stillness. So the eye hears the Buddha's teachings. I interpret it that way. Dana was very much a bhakta. But if you just think of that as, this is what the Buddha's teachings promises. That it'll always be there. Despite, as she says, there's going to be times when we suffer, there'll be times when we're hard. The Buddha's teaching is always there to keep us going along the path if we just pay attention. And it's there sometimes. It's like a voice in the twilight. Sometimes there we are struggling, and we just something says, no, no, you can see where this is going, do this. And then sometimes there's no voice. The night went back to stillness. But we know it's there. This is called taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. That's what taking refuge really means, I think. It's having that faith that we're supported by these teachings and by the Sangha, and we're going in the right direction. That's my sense of the poem anyway.